Marilyn, first of all, thank you for agreeing to participate. I think you'll have some really valuable perspectives to share. So, Marilyn, why don't we dive in? Generally, we have started by asking people to provide a little bit of a summary about what they've done and how they've arrived at this current role.
Sure. I started out in my undergraduate career as a French major and fell in love with a Texan and realized I wasn't going to be speaking French real often. And in that process, changed my major to political science. And somewhere in that study, I realized how important it was to know something about computers. This was really before there were computer science majors for anything except the hardcore hardware types. And so I decided on graduation not to do graduate school, and a couple of graduate schools helped me make that decision, and took a job with the Federal Civil Service as a computer programmer. They sent me to my first COBOL class, which was taught, it would turn out to be advanced COBOL, was taught by a man from Georgia. And I had trouble being a person from the New York City area with both the Southern accent, even though by then I was married to a Texan, and the computer lingo. So I felt like, even though I had quite a facility with foreign languages, I had really entered some new zone. But I came to really appreciate the part of computing that was involved in the interface between understanding what people needed and wanted and figuring out what computers could do for them. And that, I think, really inspired me to stick with computing and not slip back into political science per se, although my own interpretation of politics and political science is it's about decision making and about support building for decisions and about aligning values in a complex society. And I think all of those things I learned about political science in college have been really applicable to my work in computing as I went forward. So I spent 3 or 4 years doing computing and then took a real leap of faith and went out of the workforce for 6 years while my children are small. My son and daughter are just a year apart, so I had a concentrated dose of early childhood parenting, and was worried about whether I would be able to return to the workforce with any kind of credible skills. Found out that I could and did, and my first job when I got back in was writing a payroll and labor distribution application, which turned out to be in Fortran, because that's what my boss spoke, for a small planning commission in Northern Virginia. And from then on, I have been basically working full-time ever since. Joined MIT in 1977, where I really liked the idea that all my clients, up to then I had worked in consulting firms, and all my clients were local, and spent 19 and a half years at MIT in a variety of leadership jobs, working directly for Jim Bruce for like the last dozen years that I was there. In 1996, I went to Stanford and had a really excellent time while I was there and got the call in early 1998 about NYU deciding to create the CIO role here and decided to take a look at that and ultimately arrived here at NYU with the opportunity to create the role, which was to me very appealing. And it's been and a very interesting ride ever since. So that's generally, you know, I didn't start out with the purpose of being in computers, but once I got involved and found the niche between the people and the technology, to me that's been the intriguing part all along.
You've operated in several different kinds of sectors, if you will, not just in higher education. You were also in the federal service. You also did some work privately.
Right.
Anything that you would observe about the compare and contrast among all of those different kinds of experiences?
Well, I certainly, in almost every move I've made, except the one to NYU, have taken a kind of a step back in some fashion, either back to a role I had previously or back in salary a little bit, in order to be able to experience whatever the new aspect of the role was. At first, when I used to look at that, I thought that was a drawback, but I actually think there's an advantage. For example, when I went to Stanford, by the time I left MIT, I had responsibility broadly working with Jim Bruce for sort of operational management across the IT landscape at MIT. And in fact, we were also doing reengineering at MIT. So I had led the team that basically transformed the leadership structure of IT at MIT. The job that I took at Stanford was in administrative applications and leading the projects that they had going there to transform their administrative application base. That was not very far from a job that I had had at MIT 12 years prior. But it also gave me an opportunity to try in a new context, both skills that I had built over many years of a career, as well as skills that I had acquired in those latter 10 years at MIT, but in sort of a familiar context. And that made it, you know, I look like I'm a very high-risk person, but I guess I'm actually much more of a calculated risk person. And so in my calculation, that made the risk not as big as it might otherwise have been. And it turned out then to really be a foundational success step to have taken. When I went to MIT back in the 70s, I took a pay cut to go there, but didn't take me real long to catch up with what I would have done if I had stayed in the consulting realm that I was in. So it's also different. I've experienced life both as a two-parent earning family and as a single-parent family, and your risk calculation is quite different depending on what your family situation might be at any given time. So
mm-hmm.
Very situational. I don't think there's one, you know, one answer that fits all personal situations.
I think you've already answered a bit of this, but one of the things that we've probed a little bit with our respondents is, was there ever an aha moment where you said, not only do I think I can do the job of a CIO, but I think I'm going to go after it? Or was it more a case of those calculated risks and evolving opportunities over time?
Particularly for the CIO job, there were a few aha moments, but people who work with me will probably tell you I get an aha moment a minute, and so it's hard to filter out exactly which ones are the meaningful ones and which ones are the ones that, oh, well, it's just as well she let that one drop. At the point where I was considering Stanford and considering what I would do next at MIT and considering what else I might do, I realized that I was certainly qualified to do CIOing some, or thought I might be qualified to do CIOing somewhere, and thought that that would be an interesting role to play. And I think it was that interest really gelled as a function of working on the leadership team for Jim Bruce in the first case. Partly because Jim required all of us on the leadership team to think broadly about IT and not just specifically about the role that we had at the time in IT. So working on the leadership team with Jim over that period, I worked for him on the leadership team from 84, you know, to 96. So it was quite a long period. And when we started as a leadership team, we started really as spokes reporting into a hub, and started as very territorial, being protective about whatever turf each of us had responsibility for. And by a number of different methods, Jim required us to step out of our turf consciousness into a sense of ownership and responsibility for the IT function as a whole at MIT. And I think it was really in that process. It was no moment. There were like a whole series of moments. Some of them were, oh, aha, that was a stupid thing you did, McMillan. You know, look how much better the outcome would have been if you had tried this. You know, and some of them were friendly ahas. That I got the sense that this was a doable role, not by a single person, but by a strong team of people who had a common commitment to a holistic approach to service delivery.
Good answer. In the process of describing your time at MIT, you've mentioned Jim Bruce several times. I certainly consider him to be one of the major mentors of my career. In addition to Jim as an influence on you, I presume, are there other people, if you don't want to name them by name, but other people in general that you would point to who have helped shape your career and shape your attitudes and approaches to the business that you're in over the course of your career?
Oh, hugely. You know, there have been some people strongly on the, what I would call the client side of the IT business, who have been especially helpful to me in reflecting back to me how I come across and how I could be more effective. People who have been, you know, champions of me even when I've screwed up, both technical people and client people. People from outside of my, you know, immediate business surroundings who have been particularly encouraging about, you know, sticking with a hard thing or using success to kind of propel other possibilities. So it's an uncountable number of people, including my now adult offspring, you know, who keep me well grounded in reality.
What would be, then, based on what you've learned from the way others that have helped you, what would be one of the things that you would tell those in terms of kind of networking strategies as they move up the ladder, aspiring leaders, aspiring CIOs? How do you cultivate those kinds of relationships most effectively?
Well, for me, the thing that has worked has been to find people that I think have something to offer and not expect them to be the propel Marilyn to the top people, but just people who have insights and approach them with curiosity. Sometimes it's more curiosity, you know, it's more curiosity about how they operate and what they do, and let them talk to me about that. I've, you know, on occasion sought people out to get specific feedback about myself, even though they're not in my chain of command, and been surprised by what they've told me. I can remember a lunch I did, or breakfast it was, with one of the vice presidents at MIT when I was there, when I had been working on reengineering and trying to present the point of view of the team I was running to the steering committee of vice presidents. And Bill said, "Marilyn, you're not perceived as listening." And I almost, you know, dropped my fork because I was doing training. I was giving training in how to do active listening. I was like, "Wait, catch a break here. What are you talking about?" And of course, I had to control myself and go into listening mode. But as he described what he perceived, it was very helpful. And what he was saying was, you know, when you really have an advocacy position, you don't let anybody else join you in the you know, you steamroll over other people. And that's not perceived as listening. Doesn't matter what you train other people to do. And he was right. And that was, you know, one of those very helpful moments. And fortunately, I was teachable at that breakfast. I'm not always quite so teachable.
I'm going to make an observation. I don't know you, Marilyn, but it sounds like you're the kind of person who thinks constantly, has a lot of great thoughts that come through your mind. Your aha moments that you said come fairly frequently. Do you also make time, dedicate time to kind of reflection, going away, thinking about things,
yes.
Quiet time?
Not nearly enough, generally. But, oh, yeah, I'm actually a meditator, and I do that. You know, I'm quite jealous of my spirit self. What I tried to work into the work pattern of the folks here that I work with is a similar kind of, you know, let's step back from the dailies and look a little bit at the broader picture. We have a project going here at NYU now that we started just about a year ago to celebrate the golden anniversary of computing at NYU. And, you know, that grew out of a kind of a reflection by all of us about how much we were not honoring the work of the people on whose shoulders we stand. And so, you know, I think of that as another important element that we need to take time for.
Clearly, one of the issues that all of us face as CIOs is coping with disappointments, dealing with frustrations, navigating turbulent waters. In addition to meditation, which you've mentioned, are there other things that you do, either personally or professionally, to continue to move forward in the face of successive days, weeks, months, years of dealing with the victories, but also dealing with some of the setbacks?
Yeah. One of the paradigms that was most compelling to me, and as I was preparing for this, I was trying to look for the reference to it, and I haven't found it. I think there's a book called Driving Fear Out of the Workplace, in which it's in, which is a book that I read during the time we were doing total quality management at MIT. But there's a metaphor in there for the cycle of mistrust that I've actually used in presentations that I've done at EDUCAUSE and in other seminars. And the metaphor is that if you come at the other person feeling distrustful of them, then inadvertently you present to them a facade of hostility, which actually then inspires the other person to feel distrustful of you, which hardens their facade of hostility, which only confirms for you that they really are hostile, which then drives this kind of downward spiral of mistrust and tension and, you know, unproductive expenditures of energy. But the fundamental learning from the metaphor is that the way to break the cycle is to change my own mindset about the trustworthiness of the other person. There's nothing that I can do in my behavior while I still have in the back of my mind, oh, that person is distrustful, that actually mitigates the facade of hostility that a distrustful mindset presents. And so part of what I try to do myself and what I try to interpret to the folks who I work with who also experience, and sometimes even more so, experience the setbacks, you know, on a regular basis, is to find an explanatory style for the setback that isn't necessarily one that means this was an attack on me and so I need to defend myself. I mean, one of the interesting things in the work that Martin Seligman at Penn has done is to talk about the thing that you have in your own control is your own explanatory style about to what extent you contributed to a success, to what extent you were the cause of a defeat, and to what extent those characteristics that you have are temporary or permanently inherent in your nature. So for me, working on my own explanatory style, which is not to say brush off that I had nothing to do with that defeat, or even, you know, aggrandize that I had everything to do with that success, you know, but rather to recognize that life is more complicated than that and there'll be another shot at whatever the defeat was, or at the very minimum an opportunity to learn from it, how to do it differently the next time, and not to let it create a climate of, you know, hiding out in the bunker, feeling beset at every turn any more than possible. Now for me, I can do that kind of explanatory style mastery when I'm not overtired. When I'm overtired, I have a harder job with that. And so when I find myself in one of those kinds of funks, I usually discover that, well, I've been operating on 3 hours sleep for the last 5 nights and, you know, I better go get a good night sleep or two and come back to this another day.
When you talk about your own leadership experiences, Marilyn, and you think about the kind of competencies and skills that you need today and that you've observed in both yourself and others needing in leadership positions over the past couple of decades, and then you try to project ahead a couple of decades for the benefit of the people who will be succeeding us and building the next generation on our shoulders, do you foresee any kind of significant shifts in the competencies that are fundamental competencies for a successful CIO?
Yeah, well, the thread that I see already was best illustrated for me in a diagram of ITIL, the ITIL standards, which is that the actual delivery of technology services is getting more and more complex. It has more and more components. There are more and more things that have to fit together smoothly. There's no anywhere one guy game. And so the complexity of the way an IT organization is structured and works to pull off what may look on the customer side as a simple service or a coherent single service is actually increasing over time, I think, and has every likelihood to continue to complexify into the future. You know, there may be some breakthroughs 5 or 10 years out, but for the next immediate crew of people, being able to master the complexity of managing all the parts, you know, the integration of the network and voice technologies, the pervasive requirement for security across a whole range of stuff. You know, we're basically cobbling together old generation stuff, middle generation stuff, new stuff, and try to make it all look seamless to the client community on the one hand. And then on the client side, I think we're seeing increasingly a driver of business change that's even more accelerated than the driver of technology change, and an expectation level, certainly, that nothing is so complicated that you can't just fire in the CD and boot up the application and there you go, and, you know, meet every demand that you have. So I think the role of the CIO needs to be, almost, I was describing this to a facilitator the other day, almost three-faced, a need to be able to provide a sense of decomplexifying within the complexity on the, you know, as you look into the IT organization, it's how do you manage this increasingly complex service delivery paradigm. As you look to the business side, it's how do you become incredibly responsive to the changing needs and be able to sort out what things can happen fast, what things can have, you know, take longer. How do you present, how do you interpret both of those sides to each other, and how do you build that capability into your organization? And then, you know, the third phase is the strategic one toward the leadership, toward the trustees, toward the outside community, toward, you know, national policy making. How do you influence the overall direction? So it used to be, and, you know, we're experiencing some of that in places here at NYU, that what it took was a good DP manager to be a good CIO. I think it still requires snowproof technical abilities, but it's more than being a change agent. It's how do you, you know, inspire and motivate all of the people you're working with all of the spaces, to get the best out of them to get the most effective jobs done is, to me, what's going to matter. Because after all, it's not the technology that does this. It's the people that pull it off.
What are the keys to being successful at that, getting the most out of people? What do you think are the primary elements that make someone successful in that capacity?
Well, I think being appreciative of people and not disrespectful of people is a fundamental thing. If you don't like people, and if you don't feel fundamentally optimistic about the possibilities of people to do great things and get good things done, then I don't think that a CIO role is the role for you, because you got to really like all these people, and you got to be fundamentally convinced that in their hearts, all these people want to be making good things happen for the purposes that they have. And you need to be inspiring to people that that's what you think and that's what you're about. I've been accused in the past of being Pollyanna. I think that was my reputation both at Stanford and at MIT, and I've always been well balanced by having a few curmudgeons around who keep me, you know, grounded. But to me, that's the fundamental thing. The second thing is to really be able to understand, and this is where I'm still learning every day. I'm working on a slide presentation now that hasn't got there yet. Understand the perspective of your audience and what they need to know and about what you're doing and what they need, what you need to find out from them about what they need in a way that doesn't waste their time. So I think it's fundamentally, you know, appreciation of the people part of the job and appreciation of the opportunity to learn something new every day and, you know, step up and dust yourself off when what you learn is after falling into some pothole.
Marilyn, this may be somewhat related, and it's not a question that I originally thought of. I really have to give credit to Melly Tynan for this, and it was some reflections that she had on being in the startup mode. You mentioned earlier that you were the initial, the initial CIO at NYU, and you came to NYU not having worked there before. And her reflections were about the potential for a CIO coming into a situation like that to bring fresh perspectives to the existing culture or the existing institution and to find the key to introducing those fresh perspectives while still being respectful mm-hmm. of the institutional culture and mores that have been there for a while. Does that resonate at all for you?
Oh, big time. For me, some of the most helpful material in preparing that has been the work by William Bridges. We first discovered that work when I was at MIT and we were going through the organizational change that resulted from the IT reengineering effort. And I was actually very happy to discover when I went to Stanford that that same Bridges book was on everybody's bookshelf in the organization that I was leading. That book hadn't made it to NYU until I got here. But, you know, Bridges is very eloquent about that the process of change involves an ending, what he calls a neutral zone, which I think is misnamed, but I think the concept that he has about it is right, and then the new beginning. I think the knee-jerk reaction of anyone coming into a new job is, the reason I'm here is it was all screwed up before I got here, and I am going to fix it, and I know how. And I think there's nothing more energy depleting for the organization that's here than to have a leader take that kind of a stance. And it's actually energy depleting for the leader, you know, as well. And an important part of the newbie coming in, you know, is to figure out the lay of the land and to figure out what possibly can be capitalized on about it. My favorite learning about starting something as a new venture, one in which I was really, to me, it felt like it was not a self-chosen step that Jim Bruce put me through back in the 80s when he asked me to start up a new group on architecture and strategic technology and step away from the group that I had grown up with over the prior, really, decade and come to lead at MIT. And my favorite metaphor that finally helped characterize for me how hard it was to start up that group was one, Bill, that you gave me about crabs in a bucket. The idea that generally when you're crabbing in South Carolina,
you bet,
when you've got a bucket full of crabs and you pick up any one of the crabs, what you discover is they're all clinging to each other in a pattern so that you can't just pick up one, you get the whole clump of crabs coming up out of the bucket. When you throw the next crab in, it just doesn't conveniently latch on to the nearest other one. All the crabs let go. And for a while, there's a big flailing in the bucket until then the crabs, including the newbie, knit themselves together in a pattern that's probably different from the pattern that held them together in the past. Then you can pick the whole thing up as one blob. And I think one of the important learnings for a newbie going into a situation, whether it's one where there already was a CIO or one where you're creating the role, is that just by the fact of somebody telling somebody else we might want to hire a CIO that day, you know, someday, that sets off the everybody flailing around for a while. And as a new CIO, you enter a flail and you get to knit that together piece by piece, not because you were so great at your last institution and you have all kinds of new ideas, but because you find the way to incorporate the best of what has existed as well as the good ideas you have and take a learning stance into your new role.
Marilyn, you're a huge and voracious reader. I know you read extensively in the profession and in related topic areas having to do with leadership and management and organizational dynamics and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you read other stuff as well? Do you read poetry or?
Oh, yeah. I keep at my place at the Cape 3 or 4 books going, and then at the apartment, some also. So right now, for example, I'm reading the Lincoln Cabinet book by Doris Kearns Goodwin at the Cape, and I've just gotten to the point where Lincoln is elected, and he's pulling together from the men who were his rivals for the nomination a cabinet. So he's going to wind up with a cabinet of all these people who never wanted him to be elected in the first place. And the story up to now has been the trajectory for each of these guys, Seward and Stanton and so on, you know, on their, and Chase on their own. And now they've just come together as a group going to figure out how to deal with the next tragedy that's about to inflict itself on all parts of the country. And that's one of my interesting reads. My favorite collection of poetry is actually one my daughter gave me of Anna Akhmatova, who she discovered when she was over in Moscow.
Marilyn, let me ask you two questions.
Okay.
The first question is, when you are looking at people that are in your organization who you're trying to identify and cultivate the next generation of leaders, what are the characteristics that you look for in those people that make you, that give you one of those aha minutes and say, that person or those people have what I think it's going to take to be an effective leader someday? They're worth making the kind of the extra investment in. What are those things that you look at and kind of think of as the characteristics that are required?
I look now at my leadership team, and one of the things that I most value about it is that there's people with incredible energy and actually quite a diversity of strengths, but some fundamental things I think in common. And one of those is at different degrees, but nevertheless a big capacity for risk-taking, calculated risk-taking, but well-informed risk-taking. And I think that's a very important characteristic in a leader, because you never have 100% information. So you have to have, I think, a predilection or a willingness to be able to make a move or make a choice and devise the action that's going to come from that move based on imperfect information. So risk-taking is a biggie. And collaborative consciousness is another biggie. The idea, I would say, sort of a generosity of information. I think one of the, another word for that is transparency, I guess, but an understanding that the self-holding, the holding back of information from a group, you know, the concept that information is power and I have it and you don't, is just completely antithetical to what's required to be a leader who actually gets things done and brings people along, and basically follows people running ahead of you to get things done. So the collaborative spirit is an important thing. And one of the things that we've been working on the leadership team here is the whole range of emotional competencies. And so we've instituted a practice of 360 reviews. They're developmental reviews about basically emotional competency. Do you understand yourself? Do you know how to manage yourself? Do you understand other people? And do you have a sense of how to manage other people? I have a very optimistic view that I think all of us can improve on all those dimensions, and that there are leadership skills that any one of us can develop to become more effective at leading. But, you know, as I said before, I think there are certain core values of one's being that make it possible for you to take those leadership skills further if you really believe that people are interesting and can make wonderful things happen and are fundamentally committed toward doing that.
The other question is, if you were leaving your office there today to someone that was coming in to replace you, and for whatever reason, just hypothetically, you had to leave suddenly, you passed the person coming in, and you had maybe 30 seconds, and the one question that they asked you while you were on your way out the door was, what is the one thing that you would tell me to remember?
Count on the people who are working here. They know what's important, and don't dismiss what they have to tell you about what needs to get done.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Marilyn, I want to ask one final question, because we are coming to the end of the hour, and that's the proverbial glass ceiling question. You probably get tired of being asked it, but it's an interesting question, I think, anyway, in particular because I certainly sense to a greater extent than was true 10, 15, or 20 years ago that the composition both in gender balance and racial and ethnic balance at the CIO level in higher education is beginning to change significantly, and I believe that that will change at an increasing rate over the next 15 or 20 years. You can dismiss my assumption if you'd like, but reflect a little bit, if you would, on any particular issues that you think are noteworthy that may not apply equally to Caucasian males as they might to other populations.
Well, I actually am very worried about what seems to me to be the sort of undiversifying of the workforce in IT. Coming into the pipeline, I look at the numbers of young women who are, you know, attracted to information technology and see a diminishment, not an increase. And I think there's a kind of a bulge of us women, for whatever reason, in my generation and maybe one behind. And then I look behind that and I don't see a whole lot more diversity. I think that's what I'm mulling as I listen to you talk about that. And so I think we have an obligation to really look at that early on in the pipeline and, you know, think about how to make this profession understood as a much more humanizing kind of profession than I think it appears in the outside world. I mean, I worked really hard on math anxiety for my daughter, for instance, with apparently good success. She's an aero engineer, you know, working for NASA and doing group lead stuff. And one of the most fun things for me was at a recent NASA training, which was about influence, she came back listing to me authors that I had found, you know, fascinating over my career, but hadn't really spent any time talking to her about. You know, there's this characterization of our profession that I think attracts only, I don't think it's necessarily a male-female thing. I think it attracts, you know, only certain types of guys as well. And I think we would be very well served to be more broad human diversity, have more broad human diversity, not just gender diversity in it. So,
Marilyn, we sincerely appreciate your time today. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, great to talk with you both. I think this is a wonderful project you're doing. I'm glad to be able to be helpful.
Thanks, Marilyn.
Take care. Bye-bye.